Welcome back. I'm Gary Farr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for people who play with needles. And what was that? People who love people who play with needles?
Yes, I'm opening it up to everyone now.
Yes, your new audience broadening campaign, yes.
Right, so Doug, Gary's been making fun of me because I said it's like the Al-Anon for needle workers.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just think everybody should have the opportunity to understand. And you never know, they might find that they like it.
Although
that's the opposite, that's kind of the opposite of the point of Al-Anon. But, okay, let's just run with it anyway.
Okay, yeah, let's just make it up, yeah. Okay. and the Doug is Doug Krynick from Krynick Manufacturing. Hi, Doug.
Hi there. How are you all?
We're just fine. Yeah. We're just fine. We're just making stuff up here. So
that's right. I am so excited, though. I truly am, because for me, coming into this kind of needlework after, you know, doing it as a little child and, you know, dabbling because my grandmother did it, and that's what you did because she'd throw something at you to get her, probably to get me out of her hair now that I think about it. But, and then walking away and then having Gary, you know, we talked about it and he said he was doing needlework and I said, oh, that's really interesting, probably about that tone of voice. And he's like, no, really, you should look at it because it's a lot different than it used to be. And a lot of it has to do with the different types of fibers that are available and that what, you know, effects that you can create and
right.
things you can do that you could never do before. You never would. So it drove the types of stitching that we do, I think, in a much bigger way. So to be able to talk to somebody who is involved in the production of these threads that are not only beautiful, but allow us a whole other sort of avenue of creativity is really a privilege. And I'm going to pick your brain on how to work with them well.
Okay.
Some of them are a little persnickety, so I'm going to rely on your expertise to help me out.
Oh, no pressure there.
No, not at all. Oh, my gosh.
So my first question, Doug, other than DMC, are you guys the oldest thread company in the business?
I don't think so. Well, let me see. There was one.
Got to be close.
I mean, we're
huh?
fairly old. We the company itself is 45 years old, but there are some other companies out there that are old. I mean, DMC is ancient,
right?
But there are other companies out there in different areas that they're older than we are.
Okay, but you're certainly in the top five, huh? I mean, you guys have been around a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been around a long time.
Yeah, it was your parents that started it.
Yeah, actually, it was my mom. My dad was a chemical engineer and had a background in textiles. My mom taught couturier design at different universities, and they were living in West Virginia. And my dad was 56 and a half years old, and the company he was working for fired everybody over 55.
Wow.
Oh, geez.
So he had no job, and... So they were in the car and they're going towards a job interview in Delaware, and my mom was doing her needlepoint. It was all over the car, and my dad was kind of PO'd a little bit, and he said, with all your background in couturier design, can't you come up with some way of organizing your threads so they're not all over the car? So she came home and she created the first needlepoint organizer on the market. And it held the canvas and the threads and the scissors and needles and the canvas, and you could fold it up and you can carry it on your wrist.
Oh,
and
wow.
And so about
how
nine
come we
months
can't,
later, my,
how come we don't have well, that now? What's the deal
well,
there?
There are other things out on the market that probably are less labor intensive because they made the whole thing in their home.
Oh.
They lived in an old Victorian home, and by the time they went into a building, they had one room left of a, I think it was a 12-room house.
Oh, no.
So they were living in they had their bed and their everything in the dining room. And my mom was kind of, okay, let's find a building.
Oh, I guess so. Holy shit.
Yeah, but I remember when they first got into it and my dad didn't know anything about needlepoint, and my brothers and I picked up needlepoint. We were making, because my dad was selling needlepoint canvases at one point, different people like Mazel Tov and Tina and Herb Perez. And so we would make models for them. We all learned how to do needlepoint. We make models, and he'd go out and he would sell these things. And we said, Dad, you know, you should learn how to do needlepoint because then you can talk to people better. So he learned how to do needlepoint, and he had some really great pieces. You know, he had quite an imagination.
What a left turn for your family. Holy smokes.
Yeah, but they had been in textiles. And so he worked for the Department of Navy, and he had created, one of his inventions was the D-ring.
Uh-huh.
And wow. And then he also he worked with Metallics back in the 50s, and he was trying to introduce the Navy Department to using metalloplastic to make the regalia that the Admiralty wore. But they didn't like it because it didn't oxidize in sea around in the sea. So it stayed bright goldish color instead of the green that they really wanted.
Oh.
So they nixed that. So it was 1979. He and my mom had been in a museum, and he saw a piece with a sampler from the 1600s with metal threads in it. And all of a sudden it struck him, saying, wow, you know, I could take, you know, this material and make things that would look like the gold in there. And then he came up with the idea of braiding it. And at first he had different companies braiding it for them. And then as time went on, he bought machinery. And he bought, you know, braiders and winders and skeiners. And when I came into the business in 1983, I believe we had something like 10 braiding machines. And we were always falling behind in order. So I said, well, why don't we get more? He said, my dad said to me, we can't fit any more in here. So I said, yeah, I'll show you we can. So I moved the storage cabinets out of the braiding room, and we were able to put, then we got up to 24 machines. And today we have over 130 machines.
Wow.
Wow.
And we usually work those machines at least 10, 11 hours a day. And it's a slow process to make it. And a lot of people don't, you know, they're saying, well, where's my order? And we say, well, we have to make it. So we make all the stuff, and it's all U.S. made. And so, you know, it adds a little bit more to the product there. And so, but we make all of our braids on site at our factory in West Virginia.
Now, see, that's the part, the machines are the part that I've been curious about. Because, I mean, I can see where to buy braiding machines, I mean, there's enough thread makers around the world that there certainly has to be machinery for it. But when you buy them, did you have to modify? Are you still using some of the original machinery? I mean, some of that stuff back in those years was built to last forever.
Oh, yeah, and they do last forever because we have some machines that we picked up that were built in the 20s.
Yeah.
And we're still working with them.
Yeah.
They're still operating. And we have the slow, there are lots of braiding machines out on the market today, but ours are really slow machines because we're using such a delicate fiber that, you know, we don't want it to break. And so we use they go really slow. Slowly, and so that's why it just takes a long time to make stuff.
So, another thing I wondered is just because that stuff is, a lot of it looks, is fairly complicated in its construction. So to go slowly, it's got to be frustrating at times when the orders are piling up, huh?
Yeah, and these machines weren't made to, they weren't made to use this material. And whenever we would get machines in, we'd have to modify them so that they could run the material.
Mm-hmm.
And but that I love machines. And I was going around when we bought some winding machines one time, what I noticed was that people were building them. I mean, it might sound silly, but And at that point, it just struck me that, well, somebody had to build it. And so it kind of opens a lot of doors. You can, you know, and it goes back to, I used to be a computer programmer. And when I was a computer programmer, my kind of the philosophy I followed was, if you can if you can think it, you can code it. And so right. I stuck those two together, you know, if you can think it, you can build it. And so, cause sometimes we build machines and, it's that's a lot of fun too. I just like machinery.
Well, I feel for you because so I work in manufacturing as well. So you have a kindred spirit because that's sort of the fun of it. In fact, I'm missing a big show in Vegas this week. That's all that, all it is, packaging and sort of construction machinery. And I was so excited to go, even though I don't really care for Las Vegas, but just to go to this gigantic trade show of just machines, of things built for, you know, specifically for task, and then being able to look at them and say, all right, I have a completely different task in mind. What can this thing do for me? And, you know, it's fun. That's really fun to do.
Yeah, I love going to machine shows.
Yes, yes.
It's fun.
Are you able to... How much automation are you able to do, or do you end up?
Well, we had some machines that were digital machines, and they were starting to wear out, and the old brains were starting to go. So we actually had a company come in town here, and they digitized the machines. So we were able to go through step by step by step of the process, and we're able to convert to digitize that, and that was pretty exciting. Because we gave the machines a new life.
Yeah. Yeah. So everything is made, all your stuff is made there in West Virginia. Your raw materials all pretty much?
No, we get the raw materials from different places around the world.
Okay.
And because we don't have to deal with dyeing stuff and all that, but we have people make certain things for us.
Okay.
And then we bring it in and we do all the braiding, winding, coning, skeining, packaging, labeling at the plant.
It just sounds like such a place that I would love to visit.
Yeah.
It is. Well, no, it really is. That's right up my alley. Is just seeing how all these work. Yeah. Yeah.
We get a lot of people coming by, and recently, well, in the last 2 years, we opened up a factory outlet store. And there are people who come in from all over the place, and they, they'd like to see the tour. Sometimes I'll take them on a tour. I don't take everybody on tour, but sometimes I'll take people on tour, because otherwise we'd just be inundated with people.
Yeah.
But if on a quiet day, I'll walk them through, and I'll put them up against shelves full of cones of thread, and I'll stand there with them, and they can take a selfie and take it back to their guilds and say, oh, look where I was, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. What innovations? I mean, you guys to start out and doing this metallic braid, I mean, that in its own right was quite an innovation, wasn't it? I mean, were you the first to do that or among the first?
I think we were among the first. I don't know if we were the first, but we were among the first. And, I know we were the first in making different widths for embroidery and needlepoint and cross stitch. When my parents first started, we had blending filament, we had number 8 braid, number 16 braid, and number 32 braid. And then as time went on, we got the 16th inch and 8th inch ribbon, the flat braids. And then my mom kept saying, you know, I don't think everybody in the world likes blending filament. Why don't you make a number 4 braid? And so she said that for a while, and finally we said, okay, Mom, we'll try it. Well, number 4 became at times our most popular material.
Uh-huh.
It's very easy to use. You can just stitch with it. And I think people just like to stitch with something, and it makes it a lot easier. And now what people are doing, what needle pointers are doing, they're taking the different braids and they're layering them. So they might have 16 on the bottom and then do a couple of layers of number 8 and then number 4 over top of that. And so that makes it really interesting. There are a couple of teachers out there who teach that the layered look, and it's very interesting.
No, I have not seen that. That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
It does. So what's the purpose of the blending filament then? Because I haven't worked with that yet.
Well, the blending filament, we brought out that for to blend with another thread. So say, for instance, you're using DMC or silk, and you want to put a little light into something, want to give it dimension.
Okay.
So one way of doing it is to knot the filament to the needle using what's called a lark's head knot. And you knot it to the needle. And the reason you do that is because when you put two threads together, they have different tensile strengths. So you want to stabilize one. So you stabilize the metallic, and then you can bring your cotton or your silk through there. And then if you dampen it with a little cosmetic sponge, then it blends together, and then you just stitch it. So when you stitch it, it brings a little bit of light to whatever you're doing. And so it was like the joke with vermouth, you know, just a little bit of vermouth. So this is just a little bit of light, and so it gives more dimension to things. Mm-hmm. And so that's what my parents had in mind when they first created blending filament, just to give an idea of light, and that idea of light would give a third dimension to a piece rather than being flat.
I think it's interesting too that the reason that this whole thing got started was that it's like all good inventions, it was a failure, right? So the military people were looking for something that would oxidize. And so you succeeded because you created something that doesn't oxidize.
Right.
So to me, that's probably the first and perhaps the greatest part of this whole invention is the fact that you've, are using materials that don't react to the environment, which makes for a stable piece.
I grew up, both my parents were inventors, and I just grew up with, failing is okay.
Yes.
When I was a programmer, when the program didn't work, that's how you learned.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the environment I grew up in. So, I mean, we create lots of things that don't make it, and but there's nothing wrong with that, because from that learning, you learn things.
Right. That's where does that sound familiar from, Gary?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No kidding.
So I'm the scientist of the crew.
Okay. Here.
So I say that exact thing all the time, and I just follow it up with, if you're going to fail, good inventors fail quickly. So the faster you fail, the faster you get to the thing that's going to be, something really spectacular.
Right.
Back when you guys started, I mean, that was still the basket weave wool on painted canvas days for the most part.
Oh, yeah.
That must have been quite an education to get people to take a look at what you had.
Oh, what my dad would do, he'd fill up his pockets with silk thread and metallic thread, and he'd walk around and introduce himself to designers and give them samples.
Okay.
And so a lot of it in the beginning was all education. And so the main thrust of the company became education, to educate people.
Mm-hmm.
And actually today we're going through the same thing, because the new stitcher, a lot of them shop just in maybe a Michaels or in a Hobby Lobby, and there's not the same sort of choice as you get in small, brick and mortar shops.
Right.
And, so those people, the millennials, have to be taught that there are other types of things out there, and they should experiment, and it's fun. Some people are afraid to experiment and try new things out. And again, it goes back to failing and succeeding, and to see whether you like it or not. It's like trying different types of food. But it's healthy to try things out to see if you like it or not. But it's all education.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. That's, so it, as you work your way through getting people educated and you get some help along the way with other threads that come into play, and you know, the wool just kind of fades into history for mm-hmm. a lot of, I mean, really, it's hardly ever used anymore. I mean, people use
it. It's harder to get to.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, just not found. Is that, what are some of the things that you guys have developed?
Well, let me see.
Cause I think you don't, I don't know a whole lot about the company, but I think you don't get credit for a lot of things that you're responsible for.
One of the things I'm really proud of is, we created this one material. It's kind of a heavy flat braid. And it's called our 3/8-inch ribbon braid. And I played with it, and I wanted to have it so that it could be shaped, so I put wire in it. Mm. And that material was used in the costuming for Game of Thrones.
Oh.
I could see that. And I'm glad you brought that up, because there's so much use of metallic thread in old liturgical garments and in royal garments as well. That's where you see the bulk of the metallics, the gold threads, but those
gold too, yeah.
Right. So this idea that you've created something that is a facsimile of that and a good enough one that you can use it in costume design.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's interesting, just looking at the things that you guys have made has made me this is going to sound very a lot larger than it is. I have done costume work for theaters before and never knew any of these things existed. I was just thinking the other day how wonderful it would be to be able to do some of this embroidery on mm-hmm. some plays that are traditional. And my dilemma was, it's too fine. So from a theater perspective, you'd never see it, right?
Because
it's too far away. So then I was thinking, okay, well, then what do I do to build this, to bulk it up so that it's visually impactful from an audience? And you just answered the question right there, is using something that's that large, or using some of your regular threads like much the same way that you described the original ones that you had invented, where you were blending it, the blending filaments.
Yeah, well, one of the teachers that we used took three of our number 16 braids and passed it through a couching foot and did a ladder stitch over top of it and made some really interesting trim effects.
That would be cool.
Which were used on placemats and also on clothing. And then we also have our iron-on thread. And what we've discovered is a lot of new costumers can't sew. So they
I believe that.
They take the iron-on thread, and especially the ribbon, and they take that, and they might put a stencil on their clothing, and then they'll iron it down, and then they'll go and tack it down either by hand or with a sewing machine. And it's much easier, and I call it the cheater's way of embellishing, but it works. And it's fast.
Yeah, as long as it holds up, right, for the duration.
Yeah, well, once you tack it down, it will hold up, and you can wash it, dry clean it, everything.
So tell me more about this 3/8 wired ribbon, though. I'm really interested, because it seems like it's something that could be not only something that's a trim piece, but a sculptural element as well.
Yeah, that's really true, because you can, in fact, people who do finishing for needlepoint, we have three different threads, actually, that have wire in it. One is mm-hmm. a 3/8-inch ribbon. We have four colors of facets with wire in it. And then we have a number of colors of our number 16 braid with wire in it. So you can use all those to make all sorts of three-dimensional effects on on stand-up needlepoint pieces. Or even we had someone do a purse, and it was a quilted purse. And they had the wings of a dragonfly done mm-hmm. with the wired thread. And then there was another piece that was done with tulle and free motion embroidery. And did a whole piece that was three-dimensional flowers.
So No, I'm dying, like itching to experiment with these because I've been messing around with surface embroidery and lifted, you know, three-dimensional embroidery. And now I'm just seeing how these threads could absolutely come to life on the backdrop of something like that.
We've had people, when my employees unfortunately make mistakes, we take that and we dump it in a box. And I have a couple of boxes back at the plant. And, but what people do is they'll take the, what we call, bits, our bags of bits.
Yeah.
And they'll take that layer between two layers of water soluble material. And with a metallic thread in the sewing machine, they will do free motion embroidery over the whole thing. And then they use those as cutouts on clothing or all sorts of things like that. And just, it's really a lot of fun and remarkable what people have created with the bags of bits.
This totally ties into a conversation I was just talking about. I was talking about, sort of heraldic symbol, I can't even think of the words, right? So, going back in time, so if you think of medieval era and at that sort of time span, doing pieces that represent those things, right? So you were talking about swords, daggers, armor, things of that nature that to do in silk would be lovely and would look, you know, sort of true to the period, but would not have that dimension to it. Then now you're talking about a wired 3/8 inch metallic ribbon. And now this surface piece that I had envisioned, which is, you know, a dagger and something else that was, again, symbolic of a book, right? Now becomes a completely different piece in my head. Because a dagger, especially of that time, is going to be faceted. You can completely do the facets because you have now these wired ribbons that are going to go where you want them to go. And if they already have that ability to catch light and to catch light differently from different angles, now this piece in my head that 20 minutes ago looked one way is starting to build into something really remarkable just for the sake of there is a material somewhere in the world that would allow me to make that effect. So that to me is the greatest thing of all of this is that you lift off the canvas and you've gone into different directions that you could never do before just because you might be able to noodle around with this, you know, a scrap and see what it can do.
Well, we also had a designer wanting us to get some copper canvas. We found a copper canvas. It's made of copper. And she used it for the wings of dragonflies.
Yes.
And it was really, Kimberly Smith did that. And it was really cool looking.
Yeah, dragonfly wings lend themselves, insect wings in general do, because, you know, you're getting the iridescence and the light and all of those things. So, oh my goodness, how much fun to be able to play with these things.
Where do you find a copper canvas?
Oh, I love searching for things. That's fun. I mean, for me, somebody will call up and say, do you know where I could do this? Like, I work with all sorts of people, costume people. I mean, working with a hula hoop company. So, and we're also big in fly fishing. And, so we do lots of different areas because everybody uses different type, they use the same material different ways. So it's kind of exciting.
Yeah. And I have that in my head that your company is a culture of just constant ideas, good, bad, or indifferent, but I can just see a constant flow of ideas from within and from without of let's try this or that, because the fly fishing alone, we know you for threads for needlework, but then when that pops up, it's like, well, yeah, why not? That could work.
And, I was at a show one time and I saw this trend of weaving. And so I went out and I bought a rigid heddle loom and I wanted to see if my braids that I manufactured could be used for warp. And that's really remarkable looking at some pieces made with metallics in the warp and silk in the weft or other materials or even hand-spun materials. I do the Maker Faire in Detroit every year. And at the Maker Faire, they always produce a lot of hand-spun. I take that hand-spun, and they take the hand-spun, and I bring my loom in, and they use the hand-spun in the weft and with the metallic and the warp, and it is really cool looking.
That it must be. I'm dying to see photos of this because, again, you're talking about playing with light, every different way that you look at that, and depending on even the weave that you use, depending on the you know, how many threads over and under, you can completely change how something, you know, areas will go flat or matte, and then other areas will be bright.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, the ultimate I see is for someone to do their needlepoint piece and then take the same threads that they've used and get on rigid heddle loom and make the back side fabric for a pillow.
Yeah.
So they would, and then take our little cording drill that we have where you can make your own trims, and so you would have created the whole thing. I look at that as power.
Yes. Yeah.
Completed the whole. You've done the whole thing.
Yep.
That to me is cool.
It is. It is very cool. It is cool. And I had never thought of them as being used as weaving fibers. But again, you can see how many different directions you can go with that. I mean, if you got into the complicated parts of it, then you start talking about other types where you're, instead of just doing a pattern, you're weaving pictures into it and things like that. And you create that with the same color of fiber, but different. One's a metallic and one's not. One's a silk, one's a flat. And then just by the way that even a monochromatic piece, the way that light is reflected, you can see your design. That's such a cool idea too.
Have your siblings stayed with the company?
No, I'm the last. My brother, well, at one point we had like 6 members of the family in here. And I'm the last in the family to be in the business.
Okay. You have kids?
I have a daughter who's a television producer out in Hollywood.
And so that answers my next question.
unfortunately, my son is no longer around. He passed. So,
yes.
So I'm it.
There you are. Yeah, we should talk about that CAKS charity since you brought it up. Yeah, because I think that is one of the neat things. Tell about that.
Yeah, that was a really – my son had suffered from a lot of pain over the years, and he finally took his life. And he came to me in a dream and said, "Shoelaces, Dad." And so I didn't think much of it. And a couple of days later, a friend was over at the house, and she was helping my wife and was emptying a basket full of fruit. And turned the basket over, and out came a pair of shoelaces. And I went, "Whoa, that is really weird."
Right.
And so in my warehouse, 30 years before, my dad and I had purchased a shoelace machine that we could never get to operate. And so...
Wait a minute. All this happens, and you have a shoelace machine sitting in the factory?
You got it. That I never used. Because it was in Italian, and we couldn't get it to work. And so I pulled it out, and my maintenance engineer took us 3 months to finally figure it out. And we finally got it working, and now it's simple. And
of course it is.
Of course it is, you know. And so we studied about shoelaces and started making shoelaces and what goes into them. And so we started doing that. And then we make other things with that. And actually... I can make a yarn out of that too. I have a yarn I'm going to show somebody shortly for knitting, and we also make braided shoelaces, and I make braided shoelaces in tartan colors out of silk.
Oh my!
And just all these ideas came to me on doing this, and then the other day we figured out how to make a shoelace in 2 colors. So when you tie it, one side of the shoe is tied with green, maybe, and the other side is tied with red.
Oh, no.
So it's really cool looking. And a portion of the profits for that program go to a fund that my wife and I set up in support of suicide prevention, drug addiction, and grief counseling. Because in this part of the country, there's not a lot. Yeah. I mean, we have a lot of people who are addicted to all sorts of stuff, but there's not a lot in grief counseling. So we do that. And then I have it designed so that other organizations can buy the shoelaces from me, and they can make money by selling the shoelaces for their organization. So okay. it's a double thing.
Mm-hmm. So people just go to the Krynek website, and there's an area for that where they can buy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Buy these products. So making shoelaces out of two colors, immediately now you have a huge market of schools.
Yeah, which are really difficult to get into.
Oh, well, darn it.
You'd say, oh yeah, you can go to schools and weddings and roller derby and all this, but I have a lot of great ideas and it takes time and persistence. So this week we did sell a batch of pink glow-in-the-dark shoelaces to a school because in October, a lot of the schools use pink for Breast Cancer Awareness Week a month. Okay. And mm-hmm. so like the basketball team's all going to wear pink shoelaces.
Glow-in-the-dark.
So that's pretty cool.
Oh,
and
man.
Another thing about the shoelaces, it's really kind of interesting, and they take the shoelace and you go to weaving, and you can use the shoelace because it's a wide thread, a wide fiber, and you can use that in the weft, and you really get interesting effects weaving with it. So the ideas just grow, and they never end. I wake up in the middle of the night thinking of new ideas.
Okay, this is not working. This is just fun.
Well, I think, Gary, now you understand why I like the job that I do, because this is, it's a completely different industry, like completely, completely different, but it's also working with materials that create effects, that have aesthetic value, that have uses, you know, all of those things. And then, so it's the whole innovative process and trying to figure out what people want. Right. As opposed to what you think is cool, which is not always overlapping, because there's a lot of things that I think are really super cool and nobody really wants them, but that's fine. But then it's also then the idea of, okay, now how do I make this so I can make it fine on a small scale? How do I make, you know, 11,000 gallons of it at a time? And that's when the whole engineering aspect comes in, and that itself is fun because now you have to figure out a process to scale something. So each of the elements of this, from conception all the way through, you know, industrialization, has its challenges, but they're so cool because if you do it well, you can do it fast and inexpensively enough that it becomes an item that lots of people can afford and have access to.
One of my favorite things is to figure out. My thoughts are a boring job causes mistakes. And
yes.
So I like to figure out efficient ways of producing things with fewer steps. And so mm-hmm. a person can finish that job and go on to the next, and they'll make fewer mistakes.
Yes, I agree. And that's why our group, we have basically no work days. So, mm-hmm. go to your lab, go do something that is interesting to you, that I have no idea of, but that you think might be interesting, and see what you come up with. And like I said, a lot of it can be, you know, failures, and that's totally fine, because somebody else might look at your failure and say, you know, that doesn't look so good, but I bet if we did this, it would be really interesting.
Right.
So we come up with a lot of crazy good things out of those, you know, no work days, you know.
Wow, that's fascinating. That's great.
It's hard to get through, you know, a large company to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes we go a little under the radar to do it, but it's worth it because that's when we come up with, you know, because there's no restrictions. There's no, you have to make something for somebody according to their specification. It's just whatever you think. And these are people who know these materials the best because they work with them all the time. So, yeah, that to me is one of the most fun things.
Like, I had this idea, and I'm still pursuing it, and it was I had an employee who was interested in string art. And so with string art, you know, you can use wood and nails. So I had some fabric that I had lots of, and I said, well, how about string art on fabric?
Mm-hmm.
And so I created a bunch of kits with string art on fabric and then used a double-sided tape so you can make a patch. So you could finish the whole project. In 2 hours, you could have a patch. And it was pretty cool. But a lot of shop owners didn't get it. And the whole point was to get a needle in kids' hands.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
That was the whole concept.
Right.
Yeah.
But, and sometimes that's the only difference between a marketable product and not a marketable product is a story. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it comes down to as simple as your dad walking around. Sometimes it really is. The product is exactly the same, and if you have somebody tell the right story that makes people feel something or see something
mm-hmm.
that they didn't see before, then the product goes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's hard. That's really, really hard, is figuring out what it is that's going to strike a chord with somebody.
Absolutely.
You know, that's really, especially for, you know, the engineering people, because we like, you know, nouns and verbs and not a lot of adjectives, and we just want to make it.
Yeah.
Right. So thinking about it that way, that to me is the difficult part.
Doug, you go to a lot of shows. Are you getting a sense of enthusiasm from the local needlework stores about what's going on in the hobby?
Well, a lot of the shops are some shops are starting to sell, are starting to be purchased by an opening by younger people.
Well, that's
unfortunately,
good.
Unfortunately, a lot of the shops that are owned by boomers, the boomers are getting tired and saying, I think it's time to retire. And, you know, the internet has had a lot to do with a lot of shops closing. And those shops that are staying open are actually doing a lot of work on the internet, too. One of my customers 10 years ago, he was a big shop and lots of classes, and today, 80% of his business is on the online.
Mm-hmm.
So online has its place, but, you know, this is a really touchy-feely industry. And it's, you know, and the social networking is done by sitting around and stitching with other people. And but we are finding that even in the gamer groups we are attracting customers. There's one piece, and they keep telling me, don't say that, but I call it the pooping unicorn.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
And the poop is in glow-in-the-dark colors.
Well, of course.
And in a rainbow effect, and it's great. And it's spurred a lot of interest in, you can actually do that? So it's fun. So.
I don't know the pooping unicorn design.
You need younger kids, Gary. Believe me,
I raised them. No, things. I don't need younger kids. I raised
there's
them.
There's another idea I had, and it's because the sentiment on samplers is different from the traditionalist who has very historic samplers and all that. And the new sampler is coming out, and I have suggested to some shop owners having a section in their store that might say 35 years and younger only.
Mm. Yes.
So, but you have to have an open mind. I mean, you know, I at one time was on a board of the Girl Scouts, and what I learned there is, you want to be acceptable to everyone, so... You know, you have to look at the whole marketplace and be open to the whole marketplace and what can I present to make, you know, you happy and each segment happy. And you just can't make just one area, because after a while your customer base is going to die. So you have to keep growing and create for the new generations coming up. And it's tough, but you have to keep creating because sooner or later there's going to be that connect. And I see that a lot of young people are going to really take hold of hand embroidery because it's something that's very portable, and you can go into any discount store and pick up a pillow, draw a stencil on the pillow, then do one of the 6 or 7 major embroidery stitches on there, and bingo, you have a custom-made pillow. Other ideas I've had, taking digital pictures of tattoos and then digitizing it into the sewing machine and then having a pillow made with that tattoo design, and it matches your arm.
Oh, there you go, Christine. Idea.
There you go, Christine, right there. Yeah.
Well, I went to this exhibit in the New York Metropolitan Museum of Art, and it was called, I can't remember the name of the exhibit. It was about 10 years ago. And anyway, there were 6 quilted arms, and on each arm there was a cross-stitch tattoo. And I just said, wow, that's really creative. That's just, it's over the top. But it was interesting. But it was taking in culture that's happening now and blending it in with other forms of artwork. And I just thought it was interesting. It's not for everybody, but for some people, it's for some people.
Right. That's actually a trend now, is cross-stitch tattoos. So
yes, I saw that.
Yeah, you can find them on the internet if you Google it. I've very mixed feelings about them. So,
but
it's definitely, yeah. Okay. So, it's really interesting. I'll put it that way. And I think it's a cool, like you said, sort of combination of old and new, something from very long ago with something that's contemporary and trendy and hip. And I think that it's that hipster culture that's driving that sort of combination.
Right.
The jury's out on whether it's a good idea. As a person who has some tattoos, we'll leave it at that. I don't think it would be something I would choose, because not for the art's sake of it. The art is the art, and that's everyone's different taste. But looking at how tattoos age, I would love to see them, 15 years from now, to see if they still look like cross stitch. Or if they look like a sampler that somebody's run through the washing machine 17 times.
Right.
Which they may. So, yeah. And that's the skill of the artist, right? But still, it's going to be pretty cool.
Yeah.
I keep hearing just little flickers of light, things I read and hear, that the millennial generation, the younger people, are starting to look for things that are not on a screen in their hands, right, and battery powered. Do you get that sense?
I do get that. When I work, like I said, I work the Maker Faire up in Detroit, and we actually teach for free needlepoint, cross stitch, weaving, spinning, knitting, crochet, sometimes tatting, and we teach up to 1,100 people in Detroit. And in the 2 other cities that we do it in, I think it's Santa Monica and New York. New York was just past weekend. And it's like 1,500 to 2,000 people. And wow. I see that that people want to make things. They want to create things and own it. And so there is hope out there. There's a school out
there. Exactly, yes.
There's a school in San Francisco. I think it's called Art Needlework School of San Francisco. And they are actually having classes where they teach millennials how to embellish their clothing by embroidering on it.
Okay.
So there's stuff going on. It's not traditional. And I also see that non-traditional stores are bringing in different sorts of crafting and art supplies and little embroidery kits and stitching kits.
That's really encouraging, because what brought it to mind again was the other day I was out early in the morning and drove by a corner where a bunch of middle schoolers were waiting for the bus, and there was probably 10 of them, and every one of them sitting there just staring at their phones.
Yeah.
And you know, I understand that. I do it myself. You know, I'm as guilty as any of them. But and then I run across these things where these young people are starting to look at, can I do something other than stare at the phone? So I'm glad to hear that you're running into those people.
Yeah, I think there's a teacher out in San Francisco who started a program with needlepoint, and some of her students started saying, "Can we try that?" And so she now teaches needlepoint classes in her elementary school class.
Yeah, yeah.
And boys and girls.
Yeah, and that's the other part: boys and girls. Yes, yes.
Boys and girls.
It's okay. It's okay, guys.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I think you hit it. And this is funny because when we first started the podcast, I would always tag Maker Faires and makers on Instagram and Facebook and things like that. And at the time, Gary's like, "What are you doing?" But I think that's the key because the needlework groups and the EGA and all of those things, those are the older people who come to needlework through, you know, generationally. Young people come to it through maker. You know, the whole maker movement is all about doing exactly that. And I think that's a perfect place for it because that's where you get your 3D printers and people making jewelry out of that and people carving things and, you know, cooking things and all of these things. And then to bring an old traditional style, but do something like, you know, Tess and Thorne's, Biggie Small's needlepoint and do that.
Right.
You know, you can show them that it's not, you know, the home sweet home sampler that you thought it was that's been, you know, on your grandmother's wall for 60 years. You can do lots of other things. And then you add these cool fibers that are, you know, interesting and contemporary, and it's a home run. So that's exactly the audience I think you need is Maker Faire.
Yeah. That's I've been doing it. I've been volunteering for the last 4 years doing that. Because I think it's really worthwhile.
Yeah, and I've been wanting to go to the New York one, which is, you know, very close to me, and I haven't made it yet. But it's been one thing that's been on my list for a couple of years because just, you know, and I have a 14-year-old son who is, you know, very like-minded, you know, not so much with the needlepoint, but with the, you know, designing machinery and doing all those sorts of things. So doing robotics and things like that. So going to those environments and showing them those sorts of kids who have that mindset of, you know, what can I make, you know, and what can I make out of found materials?
Exactly. What can I make? That's it.
Yeah. That's exciting. And I think Maker, I think that we should make more. I think you're right on the money with that. And I think that as an industry, that's the key. That's a really, really good, place to go because that's your audience.
What I'm finding is that the traditional trade shows in not just the needlework industry, but in many industries, it's waning. Millennials don't shop that way.
No.
They shop online. But they do go to, like, the Renegade Crafts Fair or Maker Fair, and that's where they see things, and they see people working, and they see the excitement of people, and then they say, wow, I should get that product for my store. Or I really want to work on that.
Right.
And so that's it's the whole marketplace is changing, and it can't go back to the way it used to. Impossible. I have had customers saying they should make it illegal to sell needlepoint stuff and supplies and fibers on the internet. I say, go dream. This is not going to happen.
Right.
Yeah. No.
Too late.
Definitely
yeah.
Not.
Way too late.
Too late.
And they better not, because that's the only way I can get it. So
right. Well, that's it. And I asked my daughter, you know, what's your favorite place to shop? And she said Amazon. And I went, I won't tell anybody. But now the whole world knows.
Right. But it's true. I don't have a local shop. And the local shops, even in New York City that I've seen, don't cater to the type of needlework that I like to do. So, I have to travel 2.5 hours to get somewhere to find things that I don't really like. So the internet is the way to go for me.
West Virginia has two cross-stitch shops in the whole state.
Yeah.
The whole state.
The whole state. There are no needlepoint shops. There are a few knitting shops and a lot of quilting shops.
Yeah. I have family there and I could see that, exactly that. And Right, needlepoint just isn't a thing. But yeah. See, the other thing there is that if you're going to a needlepoint trade show, it's because you like needlepoint. So your audience is already built in. They already know what they're going to get. You're not hitting anybody new. But if you're going to, this is where I was talking about, you know, for me, I work in cosmetics. For me to go to a food trade show is the best thing ever because it's machinery I've never seen before. It's technology or functionality I've never seen before. So that's where they're going to get a new customer. So going to Maker, you're getting a whole new audience that hasn't been exposed, but it's already predisposed to like this sort of activity. And so the enthusiasm will be contagious. So that's where you're reaching a new audience as opposed to just the same old people that have been doing it forever. So smart. I like it.
Doug, before we run out of time here, tell me about fly fishing. There has to be a story behind how fly fishing becomes part of your company.
Well, years ago, there was this woman in Virginia who was doing her needlework, and she dropped a piece of braid on the floor. Her husband comes through, sees this braid, makes a braided body for a fly, goes to his wife and says, "What is this stuff?" And she said, "Go get your own stash." So he called us up, and my brother and I went down to visit him, and that's how we got into fishing. And we did a couple fishing shows, and we learned, you know, the terminology and all that. And we have all sorts of fishing stuff, you know, that can be used in flies. We have piping. In fact, we had this one product, chenille. We called it micro-ice chenille. And one day, one of my needlepoint customers said, "You know, I saw this stuff that you sell to fishermen. Why can't you sell it to us?" And all of a sudden, it struck me that, yes, I should be selling this to you. So, you know, sometimes things aren't so evident. But after a while, it's really fun, and we can play with things that we have, and it's fun. Yeah, because we work with people in all industries. We work with jewelry companies and archery companies and, like I said, hula hoop companies, fishing companies, costumers. It goes on and on. People make purses. There's some big interior design companies we work with. It's just keeping a really open mind and figuring out where else can I sell this.
Okay, now I got to know. I spent my entire childhood and adolescence doing tournament archery. What are you doing with an archery company with what you make?
We make some braided products for him, so that he can fish at night.
Bow fish at night.
Bow fish at night.
Okay.
Wow, so that's crazy.
Glow in the dark material.
Okay, because I've done the bow fishing thing. That's a fascinating little aspect of that sport. Yes. Holy smokes, you get everything.
Yeah, and we've also done some medical stuff too. There was a research school that wanted us to make some stuff out of some silver, very special silver thread, and he wanted us to make a sewing thread, but I couldn't, so I made a braid, and he liked that because it worked better, and it was to detect whether there was cancer on a person, and they had the silver, and it would do something. I don't know what it would do, but the silver material would tell them whether there was cancer underneath the skin in different parts of the body.
That's pretty cool.
So yeah, we get to play.
I hope you're writing all this down. That's a book.
Yeah, well. Somebody did come to me one time and say, "You really should write a book." But yeah,
in your spare time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
And
all right,
who
Doug.
Who wants to write a book when you're busy playing around though?
Yeah,
that's
no
the
kidding.
Thing. You have to trade back and forth.
Skip the book. Yep. Doug, this has been fun. You got to come back now.
Fun.
This is there's more stuff to learn here. I can tell.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for making time with us this week.
Okay,
we really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. This has really been fun.
Yep. Well,
yes,
we appreciate
definitely.
It. Yep. All right. Okay. Thanks to everybody for listening, and we'll be back Wednesday.